Okay. So I'm going to attempt to do another PowerPoint. Oops. We have a lot of gadgets here, and I'm hoping they'll all work. So one of the interesting literary devices used in the scriptures is the alphabetic acrostic. This is a set of scriptures in which each verse or group of verses begins with a letter of the alphabet in sequence. The most famous example is Psalm 119. As a matter of fact, the second song today you sang from Psalm 119. But I'll bet none of you noticed the acrostic nature of it. Because you sang it in English. Turn that off so it's not distracting. You sang it in English. And the acrostic, of course, is in Hebrew. Nevertheless, many of you will have Bibles that show how this psalm is arranged. The psalm is grouped in 22 sets of 8 verses each. Each verse in a set begins with the same letter of the Hebrew alphabet, so that each of the first 8 verses begins with the first letter, Aleph. Each of the verses in the second set of verses begins with the second letter, Beit, and so on for the 22 letters of the Hebrew language. The psalm itself is an ode to the perfect law of God, and it is generally felt that the author used this device of the alphabetic acrostic to emphasize the perfection of the law. But Psalm 119 is not the only place in Scripture where this literary technique is used. For example, Proverbs 31:10, which reads in English, "Who can find a virtuous wife, for her worth is far above rubies?" The first letter of this verse in Hebrew is Aleph. The second verse starts with Beit, and so on. These 22 verses describing what the author, probably Solomon, considered to be an exceptional virtuous wife, is also a perfect alphabetic acrostic. Psalm 111 and Psalm 112 are also perfect acrostics, although each of our English verses contain multiple phrases, each phrase starting with the next letter. So the first 8 verses use up 16 letters, and then each of the last 2 verses contain 3 verses to use up the last 6 letters of the alphabet. Subject matter is the works of God and the blessings of fearing God, respectively. The acrostic form adds to these concepts in conveying a positive message. But perhaps more interesting and curious is that there are even more acrostics which are not perfect. There is some small anomaly which messes up the perfect alphabetic nature of the psalm or chapter. For example, Psalm 145. He's saying 145 for the first song today. Psalm 145 is an acrostic dealing with the greatness of God and his attributes, but it contains only 21 verses. The 14th letter, the letter Nun, corresponding to our letter N, which is also our 14th letter, is missing in the Masoretic text. Why? Was it an error in the text? Perhaps. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint contain an extra phrase in verse 13 that starts with this missing letter. Those of you who have an RSV or NIV translation will find a translation of this phrase, which in the NIV reads, "The Lord is faithful to all his promises and loving toward all he has made." And it certainly fits the context of the psalm about the greatness of God. But other imperfect acrostics are not so easily resolved. The Book of Lamentations is a book of acrostics. Each of the first 4 chapters is a separate acrostic. But while chapter 1 is perfect, chapters 2, 3, and 4 are not. For some reason, Jeremiah swapped the 16th and 17th letters, Pe and Tzadi. Why did he do this? The acrostic psalms 25 and 34 have 1 or 2 missing letters, And both have an extra verse at the end that starts with the letter Pei. And acrostic Psalm 37 also has a missing letter. Again, why? Are we looking at mistakes in the original Hebrew text? This is what many scholars believe. They feel they probably started out perfect, but over years of copying, errors crept in. The problem with that theory is that the scribes who copied these texts over the centuries were extremely meticulous. Their work was checked and double-checked, and you would think that one of the most obvious errors to catch would be a broken acrostic. Something like that would not go unnoticed for long. So, while it says in Proverbs 25, verse 2, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter, it is the glory of kings to search out a matter. We can just let it go and decide we can ask God or David someday, or we can examine these psalms in greater detail and see if perhaps we can search out a reason. Were these broken acrostics merely a matter of decay over the years? Or were they broken deliberately by the author? And if so, why would he do that? Recently, in trying to look into this subject, I came across an essay by a Jewish scholar named Ronald Benin. He titled his work, Evil and the Disruption of Order, A Structural Analysis of the Acrostics in the First Book of Psalms. This scintillating title may seem a bit academic, but I found the essay fascinating. And today I would like to share his observations and theory that David either knew exactly what he was doing or that God inspired what he wrote to not only convey the message through words, but through unusual literary devices centered around the Hebrew alphabet. He argues that rather than dismiss an anomaly as an aberration, the absence of a letter or any other deviation from the expected normal pattern ought to focus our attention on that fact and lead us to meditate on just why the disruption is there. These are things that are totally lost in English, and few, if any, of us are familiar enough with Hebrew to pick these out. But I hope as I unravel this for you that you will be inspired by the complexity of these psalms buried under the surface. Perhaps the most severely broken acrostic is the one which I have not mentioned yet. Psalms 9 and 10, if taken together, form what is generally believed to be an alphabetic acrostic. We sang Psalm 9 as the third song today. The first half of the alphabet is used in Psalm 9, and the second half in Psalm 10. The normal pattern is for every other verse to form the acrostic with a non-acrostic verse in between, but this is not always the case. Sometimes the attached verse is missing, and sometimes there are extra attached verses. In Psalm 9, the fourth letter, Dalet, equivalent to our letter D, is missing. I'll be using charts like this, which Mr. Benin included in his essay. The psalm and verse numbers appear on the right side. The Hebrew Bibles number the title or superscription, so this is not actually a verse. They call it verse 1. We call it the title and don't number it at all. The problem with this is, that our verses are off by one, which will be a bit confusing, but I hope we can get through that. Hebrew, of course, reads from right to left, and you can see the primary verses, those that form the acrostic, are highlighted here in yellow, or whatever color that is on your screen here. If we turned off the lights, it might be better. And the extra verses are highlighted in gray, which are these ones in between. And you can see indication of where the disruptions in the normal pattern occur. He's highlighted those over here. And these are this is the alphabet and what they correspond to. So in Psalm 10, we've got both of these together, Psalm 10, which should have the 12th through 22nd letters of the alphabet, six consecutive letters. 13 through 18 are missing, leaving only five of the expected letters. The pattern seems broken enough to make one wonder if the idea that this is an acrostic psalm is just wishful thinking, or perhaps David started out with that in mind and then abandoned the idea before he finished it. Perhaps. But what if he did it deliberately? And what if that deliberate action was meant to more fully convey a concept in a manner that is lost in our translations. So let's take a look at these two psalms. Psalm 9 starts out with praise to God for past help. The title reads, "To the chief musician, to the tune of Death of the Son," or in Hebrew, Muth Laban. Death of a son is kind of a guess as to what this means. They don't really know. "A psalm of David. I will praise you, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will tell of all your marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they shall fall and perish at your presence. For you have maintained my right and my cause. You sat on the throne judging in righteousness. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever." It then continues with expectations that God will help again. "O enemy, destructions are finished forever, and you have destroyed cities, even their memory has perished. But the Lord shall endure forever. He has prepared his throne for judgment. He shall judge the world in righteousness, and he shall administer judgment for the peoples in uprightness. The Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble, and those who know your name will put their trust in you, for you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praise to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Declare his deeds among the people. When he avenges blood, he remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the humble." Based on this help God has provided, David now calls on God for help. "Have mercy on me, O Lord. Consider my trouble from those who hate me. You lift me up from the gates of death, that I may tell of all your praise in the gates of the daughter of Zion. I will rejoice in your salvation." Then he returns to a meditation on God in dealing with the wicked. "The nations have sunk down in the pit which they made, in the net which they hid, their own foot is caught. The Lord is known by the judgment he executes. The wicked is snared in the work of his hands. Meditation, Selah. The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all the nations that forget God. For the needy shall not always be forgotten. The expectation of the poor shall not perish forever." And he ends this psalm with another plea for help. "Arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail, that the nations be judged in your sight. Put them in fear, O Lord, that the nations may know themselves to be but men. Selah." Psalm 10 essentially continues with a plea for help, starting out with questions about why God does not always seem to intervene. "Why do you stand off far off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" The psalm then goes into a meditation on the thoughts of the wicked and how they justify their behavior. That looks like it may end up being hard to read, but if it's, maybe you can read it. "The wicked in his pride persecutes the poor. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire. He blesses the greedy and renounces the Lord. The wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. His ways are always prospering. Your judgments are far above, out of his sight. As for all his enemies, he sneers at them. He has said in his heart, I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. He sits in the lurking places of the villages. In the secret places he murders the innocent. His eyes are secretly fixed on the helpless. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. He catches the poor when he draws him into his net. So he crouches, he lies low, that the helpless may fall by his strength. He has said in his heart, God has forgotten. He hides his face. He will never see it." These thoughts are then interrupted with a final plea for help. "Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the humble. Why do the wicked renounce God? He has said in his heart, you will not require an account. But you have seen it, for you observe trouble and grief to repay it by your hand. The helpless commits himself to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and the evil man. Seek out his wickedness until you find none." And this psalm ends with a final assurance that God will intervene. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations have perished out of his hand, out of his land, rather. Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will prepare their heart. You will cause their ear to hear, to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, that the man of the earth may oppress no more. Before we get into the possible reasons for why the acrostic is broken, let's take a look at some remarkable features of these psalms, which help establish that the design and pattern are deliberate. I already mentioned that the acrostic alphabet is split exactly in half between the two psalms. But it turns out that there are 164 words in Psalm 9 and 162 words in Psalm 10, making the word count nearly identical between the two as well. But the word Selah occurs twice in Psalm 9, which is an untranslated word generally recognized as indicating a pause. If these two words are eliminated, then there are exactly 162 Hebrew words in each psalm. If we divide the psalms up into sections using the missing letters and special words, we find some interesting patterns. Our first section is outlined in green at the top of the slide. The first missing letter, the fourth letter, turns up missing at the end of what we look at as verse 5, or what the Hebrews call verse 6. These five verses also address God directly in the second person, while verse 6 changes that focus. These five verses, plus the title inscription, contain 40 words. The next breaking point the author suggests is the end of verse 16, or verse 17 in the Hebrew, with the words meditation, Selah. That's this section here. It is outlined here in blue. This section, from 6 through 16, contains 90 words. This second section contains an interesting occurrence. The verse that begins the sixth letter, be this one here, verse 8 in the Hebrew, contains exactly six words. The verse that begins with the seventh letter contains seven words. The verse that begins with the eighth letter contains eight words. And the verse that begins with the ninth letter contains nine words, as indicated over here. And the primary attached verses for each of these letters all contain nine words. Now, the author suggests that another section goes from the next verse, verse 18, through to the first verse of the 10th Psalm. It's outlined there in green. It is right after that that these letters go missing. So that's why he chose this as the next group. He suggests that the Selah at the end of the psalm should be treated as a connecting word to Psalm 10 rather than a break. In any case, the end of 10:1 is a logical breaking point for several reasons. He points out, for example, that the last three verses of Psalm 9, those assigned to the 11th letter of the alphabet, each have nine words if we include the Selah. So it's these three right here. And that verse before it, which is the 10th letter verse, and the verse after, in verse 1 of chapter 10, is the 12th letter verse. These are the first and last verses of this section. They each have seven words, and that this 7-9-9-9-7 pattern is further indication that verse 1 belongs in this section, and Selah should not be considered as a stop word. Not only that, but the five-verse symmetrical group of 7-9-9-9-7 words is itself symmetrical within the two psalms, occurring exactly in the middle of the two-psalm acrostic in terms of verses. As I said, the Hebrew Bibles number Psalm 9 beginning with the title inscription, which pushes each of the verses up one number. Therefore, our verse 17 is their verse 18, or their 18th verse from the beginning of the psalm, while 10:1 is the 18th verse from the end of Psalm 10. Psalm 10 happens to have no inscription. This is also interesting because of the repeated significance of the number 9. The three verses in the middle each have 9 words. The group of verses is 2 times 9 verses from the beginning and 2 times 9 verses from the end. I already mentioned the many verses in the second section that contained 9 words. In fact, 14 verses in these psalms, over 1/3 of the verses in these 2 psalms, have 9 words in them. And, of course, we are dealing with the 9th psalm. If you recall, the first section contained 40 words, the second, 90 words, and this third section contains exactly 40 words again. That is, if you don't actually count the connecting Selah. The next section, outlined in blue again, next section outlined here in blue again, is the one with the 6 missing acrostic letters. Will it surprise anyone at this point that this 10-verse section contains exactly 90 words? This is an average of 9 per verse, and half of them actually have 9 words. This is our second group of verses containing 90 words, so we now have a pattern of 40, 90, 40, 90. By the way, the numerical value of each letter in Hebrew has a numerical value. Of the first missing letter of the 6 is 40. And the numerical value of the last missing letter is 90. Just coincidence, or another indication that this was deliberate? Finally, not only do we have this alternating pattern of 40 words followed by 90 words, but this then forms 2 groups of 130, with 1 section to go containing the last 7 verses, and 65 words, which is 1/2 of 130. We can also play a game with the first 2 sections we identified. As noted, there are 7 missing letters in the acrostic of these psalms, 1 in Psalm 9 and 6 in Psalm 10. If we count the words in the first 2 sections which contain one of those 7 letters, we find there are 90 such words, and therefore 40 which don't have one of those letters. These highlighted words are all the words which have at least one of those 7 letters that are normally missing from the acrostic. So the first 2 sections can be divided into groups of 40 and 90 words in 2 ways. This last one possibly confirming that these 7 missing letters are not just a mistake. And a final observation using the first 3 sections. The primary verses, those beginning with letters of the acrostic, in these sections contain a total of 83 words. All of the secondary verses which accompany these primary verses also contain a total of 83 words. Now, all of these number games can get out of hand after a while, but I mention them partly to point out that there is order in these psalms, which conveys the idea that any anomalies are intentional. So now let's take a look at just where these anomalies occur and see if we can notice anything about their placement and the reason for their existence. Let's start with Psalm 10, which is at the bottom of the screen. Verse 1 begins the expected 12th letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But verse 2 begins with the description of the wicked man, his thoughts and his behavior. This 10-verse, 90-word section we identified earlier exactly coincides with the 6 missing letters until we get to verse 12, which restarts the acrostic beginning with the 19th letter of the alphabet. Now, I would like to quote here directly from Mr. Benin's paper. It is noteworthy that this lengthy meditation on the warped logic of the wicked falls exactly at the place where 6 consecutive letters are omitted. This correlation leads us to suggest that the structure of the psalm reflects its message. The alphabetic acrostic represents proper order, the way the world should be when God is present. Mention and discussion of the wicked, who represent a breakdown in appropriate divine order, come at precisely the point where there is a breakdown in the acrostic sequence. In this 10-verse long section, which delves into the inner thoughts of the wicked, the acrostic breaks down completely and 6 letters go missing. The acrostic only gets back on track with the call for God to act and punish the wicked." Unquote. It is this idea of the disruption of order that gives us clues as to the possible reasons for the other disruptions in the orderly pattern of these two psalms. As I mentioned, the normal pattern of the acrostic in these psalms is one verse beginning with the expected letter, followed by an extra verse in two-verse couplets, alternating. 8 of the 15 acrostic letters included in these psalms follow this pattern. Psalm 9 starts out that way for the first two letters, but verse 5 or 6 in the Hebrew, which begins with the third letter, Gimel, is where we encounter the first major disruption in the pattern. There is no accompanying verse. The fourth letter goes missing, and the fifth letter has no accompanying verse either. So there's no extra verse there. This one is missing, and this one has no accompanying verse. It starts the next primary verse, as you can see over here. But verse 5, or rather verse 6 in this, in the Hebrew translation, is also the first verse which contains the word wicked, which occurs right there. And it reads in our English translation, "You have destroyed the wicked, you have blotted out their name forever and ever. O enemy, destructions are finished forever, and you have destroyed cities." The author suggests that this may be the reason for the breakdown. Mentioning and even addressing the wicked directly seems to result in the fourth letter, Dalet, to be missing completely, and for the extra verses to vanish as well. It is only with verse 7, "But the Lord shall endure forever," that order is restored and the pattern begins to come back. But unlike the six missing letters in Psalm 10, which at least have 10 verses to replace them, there is no verse to replace the missing fourth letter in Psalm 9. What we have instead are phrases describing what God does with the wicked. "You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever." In verse 5, "And even their memory has perished." In verse 6. Perhaps the fourth letter vanishes without a trace, just as the wicked do when God is involved. As I said, order begins to be restored with verse 7, except that the four-verse section through verse 10 comprises only the 1/6 letter of the alphabet. The author suggests that perhaps the two extra verses make up for the missing extra verses for the third and the fifth letters, but they also comprise a fairly cohesive block discussing what God will do for those in need. "But the Lord shall endure forever. He has prepared his throne for judgment. He shall judge the world in righteousness, and he shall administer judgment for the peoples in uprightness. The Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. And those who know your name will put their trust in you, for you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you." You may notice that "Lord" occurs three times in this group of verses. What we don't see in our English translation is that these verses contain 29 words. "Lord," or Yahweh, is the first word. It is the last word. And it is the 15th word occurring in exact middle of this 29-word section. The following three letters, 7, 8, and 9, shown here, return to the normal pattern. But there's one final disruption in Psalm 9 involving the 10th and 11th letters, which occurs right here. The 10th letter verse does not have an extra verse after it, and the 11th letter verse has two extra verses after it. Once again, is it just coincidence that the second and third times that the word wicked appears are in verses 17 and 18. Have the wicked disrupted order again, even if only slightly? Earlier we looked at the major disruption at the beginning of Psalm 10, which caused six letters to disappear. It is interesting that each of the first three verses in this section contain the word wicked. Verse 12 picks up the acrostic with the 19th letter and an attached verse, but the attached verse contains the word wicked again, which is right here. As with 9:16 or 17, that was up here, actually. The appearance of that word means the following letter loses its extra verse, so the 20th letter verse stands alone again. This brings us now to the last two letters and the last verses of the psalm, which return to the normal pattern. So this one is missing, but these are in the normal pattern. A letter, an extra verse, a letter, and an extra verse. What's interesting, though, is that this verse not only contains the word wicked, but three other variations. It contains wicked once, wickedness once, and evil man. Yet no disruption of the pattern occurs. The author suggests the reason for this is contained in the message of these four verses. Verse 16 announces that the Lord is King forever and ever. No disruption can occur when this is the case. And he suggests that verse 15 itself hints at this lack of disruption when it says, "Seek out his wickedness until you find none." Or by implication, "Seek out the disruption and disorder caused by the wicked, but you will find none, not with God as the King." To quote directly from the author again, the very form of the acrostic reflects its central message. The message is that evil disrupts the natural order of the world, and the ramifications of evil are far-reaching. However, evil can only exist when God allows this to happen. This is poetically represented in the structure of the acrostic, where any occurrence of the word wicked disrupts either the acrostic or the primary attached verse pattern. However, an invocation of God to act or a description of God in his active role as King puts the acrostic back on track. It's a fascinating theory that supports the idea that the very fact that the acrostic is broken is actually part of the message of the two Psalms. The author goes on to suggest reasons why the other broken acrostics are broken, and that they too are broken for a reason, not from scribal errors. But I won't take the time to analyze them today. We know, as with all scripture, these two psalms were inspired by God. So was all of this an accident, or was this acrostic broken deliberately? I'm guessing it was deliberate, that God inspired that too, and they did it for a reason. The remaining question is, did David himself know what he was doing, or did God cause it in spite of him? That I will let you decide. Mr. Koser.